This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Millions of Americans pop a vitamin C at breakfast, take a dose of ginseng for a natural energy burst in the afternoon, and choose Echinacea if they start feeling a cold coming on. When they have to let their belts out a notch, they turn to Ephedra. Dietary supplements are a multi-billion dollar business, but how do we know whether what's on the label is what's in the pills? Can we believe the promises? By law, these products are not considered drugs and are not regulated the same way that over-the-counter and prescription medications are. An editorial in today's Journal of the American Medical Association calls on the Food and Drug Administration to change that. Later in the program, we're going to be talking about houses that are designed to resist high winds. This, of course, as those of us here in the East are getting ready for the invasion of Hurricane Isabel. And we're going to be talking with some of those who are surfing the storm surge. They're on the coast of Long Island in New York. But first, dietary supplements. If you use them, how do you find out what's in them, what they can do for you, and what the side effects might be? Does this industry need the regulation of pharmaceutical drugs? Join the conversation, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, or email us, TOTN@npr.org. And later in this hour, we're going to be speaking with a watchdog group that tests supplements. But first, we turn to JAMA. Joining us now from his office in Chicago is Dr. Phil Fontanarosa, and welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Neil, thank you very much. A pleasure to be with you.
Why do you think dietary supplements should be regulated like drugs?
Well, Neil, these agents certainly have biological activity. They affect cells, tissues, and organs. They have side effects. That, to me, sounds like a drug.
And you also point out in your editorial that they claim to do a lot of the same things that drugs do.
That is exactly right. By law, dietary supplements can't claim to cure diseases, but they certainly can claim to improve memory, enhance joint health. But I think what we've seen is that as more and more rigorous evidence comes to the fore, that when supplements, herbal therapies, etc., are evaluated rigorously, the evidence shows that they're really not quite as effective as they might be claimed to be.
In some instances, and your editorial again points this out, there are regulations, but they're not enforced. How come?
Well, I think the major problem is that the main regulations governing these products are now almost 10 years old. And during that time, we've learned a lot. There's been scientific evidence showing lack of effectiveness and some real harms. And so I think we're left with regulations that are outmoded, outdated, and I believe inadequate for these products.
Real harms? You consider these dangerous at times?
Well, at the top of your show, you mentioned Ephedra, and I think some of the lessons we learned this past April from Ephedra is a clear example of some of the harms of these agents.
How vigorous are doctors in general about discussing the dangers of supplements, counteracting, in fact, some of them counteract prescription drugs that people are also taking at the same time?
Your point is a very good one, Neil. In fact, one of the studies in this issue of JAMA, researchers looked at St. John's wort, and they found that this product gears up some liver enzymes that, in fact, metabolize a lot of other drugs. So patients taking St. John's wort with some other drugs might have more metabolism of those drugs and therefore reduced effectiveness. I think that this study, and many others that have appeared in the medical literature over the past few years, have increased physicians' awareness to these products, and I think more and more physicians are routinely asking their patients about the use of various supplements.
The Food and Drug Administration does have authority to act in at least certain circumstances. Why aren't they more active? Are they too busy?
I think in many cases they are a bit hamstrung by the current regulations. Again, the DSHEA regulations, the Dietary Supplement Health and Education Act of 1994, has stipulations and regulations by law in place. But according to a 2001 Office of the Inspector General report, these supplements don't require product registration, manufacturer registration, pre-market approval, or mandatory manufacturer reporting of adverse events. This is the current state of regulation. It seems to me that that is what needs to be changed.
The advertising, though, is regulated by another agency altogether, the Federal Trade Commission.
That is exactly right. The FTC is responsible for being sure that there is truth in advertising, that the advertising for these products must be truthful, not misleading, and that there needs to be substantiation for all objective product claims.
How bad a problem is this, do you think?
I think it's a problem when we have agents that are so heavily marketed, so readily available, yet there's not clear evidence of safety or efficacy to support them. I think that in some cases, certainly not all cases, but in some cases, there's a risk to the public.
A lot of people would point out that the American Medical Association, and JAMA, of course, is the journal of the American Medical Association. It is, by definition, the medical establishment. And this is the medical establishment seeking to crush alternative medicines, things that people turn to when they don't trust doctors all that much.
Well, let me first say that the journal is editorially independent from the AMA, but the AMA has come out calling particularly for ephedra, that this is a harmful agent. But let me also say that I think this is a sign of the public's interest, not only in taking more control of individual health, but in a pervasive interest in wellness and disease prevention, which I think is a positive thing. And when there are readily available agents that are making disease claims that individuals can use with the hopes of preventing various illness or curing illnesses themselves, it seems that it's pretty easy to understand the popularity of these products.
And yet, what changes would these products be less available? Would they be more expensive if the kind of regulation that you're advocating was actually enacted?
Well, there are really no simple solutions. I think we would all agree to that. We now have a far-reaching and complex problem. I think that simply applying for some of these agents the same regulations we have in place for over-the-counter products, over-the-counter medications, would be an important first step. Indeed, this will take time, this will take effort, this will take resources, but it's clear to me that more rigorous oversight of and regulation of these dietary supplements is essential.
And you get that doesn't answer the question. It may be essential, but would the regulations make these less available, and would it make them more expensive?
I would hope that what the regulations would do is make products that have no scientific evidence of their benefit, of their effectiveness, much less available, yes. And I would hope that with good pre-marketing screening of these products, that evidence that shows agents that are harmed from some of these agents would prohibit or preclude these agents from coming onto the market, indeed.
Our phone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. And let's go to Charles, who's with us from Sardinia, South Carolina.
Yes, sir. Thank you for taking my call. I listen to your show all the time. I'm just concerned that the FDA is overburdened enough with cancer and AIDS trials and things of that nature that if we add this to the mix, it'll just slow down the really important things that they have to do.
Well, Dr. Fontana Rosa, what do you think?
I think the FDA has an important responsibility and responds to many challenges very, very well. Perhaps there can be a national clearinghouse where there's an independent evaluation of these products by and funding from the manufacturers of these products to have the products vetted, appropriately analyzed, and evidence provided before they can come on the market, and then have products that do qualify through that system scrutinized by FDA.
Okay.
But I guess my concern is really that the people out there that need AIDS and cancer medications that are in trial are going to actually suffer a longer period of waiting time until such time as an agency or a funding from a private corporation could be established.
Yeah, how do you balance those priorities?
I'm not sure it's an either-or priority. I think that funding for cancer trials, for AIDS trials, and for other good drugs certainly will continue, and will be independent of this endeavor.
Okay. Charles, thanks very much for the call, and stay dry over the next couple of days, okay?
10-4, sir.
Bye-bye. Before we let you go, Dr. Fontana Rosa, how likely do you think that enactment of such a regulatory change is? I mean, as we mentioned, this law was passed not all that long ago.
Well, the law might not have been passed that long ago, but since the time that it was, almost 10 years now, we have a lot more evidence available. I did a search on our PubMed, on Medline, and dietary supplements, and since 1995, there's been more than 7,000 citations to articles in the medical literature on these products. And I think with that amount of scientific evidence, I think that the evidence should be driving the policy rather than other factors.
Dr. Fontana Rosa, thanks very much for being with us today.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
Phil Fontana Rosa was on the phone with us from Chicago. He's executive deputy editor of the Journal of the American Medicine and Journal of the American Medical Association and co-author of today's editorial on regulation of dietary supplements. Joining us now from our bureau in New York is Dr. Todd Cooperman. He's president and founder of ConsumerLab.com, which tests dietary supplements for accuracy in labeling. He's the co-author of a new book on some of their findings, called ConsumerLab.com's Guide to Buying Vitamins and Supplements, What's Really in the Bottle. And Dr. Cooperman, welcome.
Thanks, Neil. Thanks for having me on.
I know you've read the JAMA editorial. Roughly, do you agree with it?
I generally agree that there needs to be more enforcement of the current regulations and some additional regulations. It's a very hard thing to balance for the FDA. Really, the bottom line is a lack of resources over there. We have been testing these supplements for the past 3.5 years, found lots of problems, yet the FDA has really not acted on just about any of these things that most of the public is aware of at this point. I put this question to the FDA at a meeting just 2 weeks ago and asked them, you know, why don't they do anything about this? And they said it's really a lack of resources. And they've been focusing their efforts right now on just kind of the low-hanging fruit, which is just going after outrageous medical claims that are being made on supplements, but they're not really looking inside the products to see what's in the bottle.
Now, when you say you test these things, do you test them for efficacy or do you test them to see if they are what they say they are?
The latter. We're looking to see if a product claims that it's a saw palmetto product or a chondroitin or glucosamine, that it has the amount of ingredient that it claims to have. We're also checking to see if that amount is even relevant to getting a clinical effect to the product working. We also look to make sure that that product will break apart. There are products we've tested that will just go right through your body. We actually needed a hammer recently to break apart a cholesterol-lowering product. We also look at other contaminants in these products. For example, we find pesticides and herbals and potentially carcinogenic pesticides, heavy metals, bacterial contamination. So there's a whole series of tests that we put these products through.
And whether the dosage is what's advertised as well.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
We're going to take a short break now, and when we come back, we're going to continue our conversation with Dr. Todd Cooperman about his new book, The Guide to Buying Vitamins and Supplements, What's Really in the Bottle, that from ConsumerLab.com. And later in the program, we're going to be joined by the president of the Council for Responsible Nutrition, which represents dietary supplement manufacturers. We also want to hear from you. 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. How important is it to you that what's on the label is actually in the bottle? Is it time for federal regulations? We'll be back in a minute. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're discussing oversight of the dietary supplement industry. If you'd like to join the conversation, our phone number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK, the email address, totn@npr.org. Our guest is Dr. Todd Cooperman, the founder of ConsumerLab.com. And well, let's go right to a caller. And Sue joins us on the line from Buffalo, New York.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Hi. I had a comment. I've been studying herbal medicine probably for almost 3 years now. And I think that there are a lot of really reputable companies out there that if you educate yourself and do research that you can find companies that will stand behind their products and are what they say they are. So I don't necessarily think that always federal regulation is necessary with everything. I'm also a distributor for a company in Utah who does all their own internal testing and has been around since 1972, and they buy their products from the same place every time. So I think that they do probably a better job than we could if the federal government got involved with their company.
Well, Sue,
it's more conscientious.
Yeah, Sue, other than the products of the company I guess you work for, how do you go about doing this research?
I think that you have to research, like, if you, like, they have so many supplements in the grocery store. I think that you have to find the company. I think you have to research who they are. Like, the company that I distribute for, you can go to their website and you can see all about who they are and how long they've been around, and you can call them and talk to different people there. They're always willing to be completely open about who they are.
Mm-hmm. Well, Dr. Cooperman, I've just glanced at your book. I haven't had a chance to go through the whole thing, but one of the things that you found in it was that herbals were the most problematical.
Yeah, actually, we found that 1 out of 4 supplements that we've looked at has some kind of problem. And the question that Sue asks is one we get very often, which is, you know, can you just rely on one manufacturer that's doing a very good job? And unfortunately, the answer is no. We've tested hundreds and hundreds of products, and it's a very rare situation where a manufacturer is doing a good job on all those products. Even the biggest names out there, we have found problems. And, you know, odd things like a vitamin C product might contain everything it's supposed to have, but it doesn't break down. And, you know, from a very reputable manufacturer, other manufacturers just may be a little low, you know, maybe 70% instead of 100% of what they're providing. To have only, you know, 1 or 10% of what they're providing is unusual for a reputable manufacturer, but certainly there are plenty of times that we've seen that kind of problem as well. So it's very hard just to rely on a single manufacturer. You really have to kind of go product by product.
Well, joining us now from Tucson, Arizona, is Annette Dickinson. She's president of the Council of Responsible Nutrition, which represents dietary supplement manufacturers and suppliers, and it's good of you to be with us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
I wanted to get your reaction to the JAMA editorial that says supplements should be regulated like prescription and over-the-counter medications.
Actually, dietary supplements have been regulated as a subcategory of foods since at least 1938. The 1938 Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act does include them in a category of food for special dietary uses. So we've had a lot of experience here, 40 years of experience,
yet
regulating these products as foods.
As foods, but not regulated in the same way as over-the-counter medications and as pharmaceutical drugs.
No, that's correct. And so I believe the experience we've had with them indicates that there is not a need for regulating them as drugs and that they are well-regulated as foods.
Well-regulated, though the problems pointed out in the JAMA editorial and as our guest Dr. Cooperman is pointing out in his book from ConsumerLab.com, there certainly are some problems.
There certainly are some issues of enforcement. We certainly do believe that FDA could and should be enforcing regulations that prohibit manufacturers from failing to provide everything that they say is in their product as indicated on the label. The law and the regulations clearly require that they do that, and we fully favor enforcement against any company that doesn't fulfill its obligation to consumers, because obviously consumers rely on these products to have what they say they have. Likewise, the law and the regulations require that any claims made for these products be substantiated.
Mm-hmm.
This is another area where we feel that there has not been an adequate amount of enforcement of this requirement, and we certainly would support that enforcement, because it's actually unfair business practice to good companies for outliers to be making false claims, to be cutting short on ingredients in their products, and thereby not meeting consumer needs.
Sure, bad apples make everybody look bad.
Absolutely.
But a lot of industries, sometimes in an effort to avoid more stringent federal regulation or state regulations, will self-regulate. Would CRN consider that as an option?
We have been working toward self-regulatory programs. We are also supporting FDA and FTC enforcement against misleading claims and products that don't have what they say they have. We filed a complaint with FDA and FTC earlier this year on a number of outrageous claims that were being made for coral calcium products, for example, and the agencies did take action against those products.
Let's take a call. Robert joins us now. Robert's in Plymouth, Indiana.
Hi.
Hi.
I think that testing, similar to the testing for drugs, is very expensive, and since the substances, some of which have proven benefits, such as vitamin C and folic acid, can't be patented, who's going to provide the funding for the testing? As a single company is going to be very reluctant to pay for this testing, as it will adversely affect their bottom line at the same time it affects their competitors with benefits.
And Todd Cooperman, I guess that's in a way the same question I was putting earlier to Dr. Fontanarosa. Would this kind of regulation, this kind of testing, drive up prices?
I'm sure it would drive up prices, and it would, you know, probably knock a lot of products off the market. It's such a tough thing because, as has been said, the vitamin C, other things, these are not patent protected ingredients. So there's no vested interest for any manufacturer to spend much money in testing them. Unfortunately. Fortunately, the government has stepped in about 2 or 3 years ago through the NIH to start testing some of the bigger popular supplements like saw palmetto, ginkgo biloba. Results are due out in the next couple of years. But that's it's a real dilemma. And at this point, it's really a buyer beware situation for consumers.
Okay. Robert, thanks very much.
Thank you.
And here's an email that we got from Matthew McMurray in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. He writes, I agree dietary supplements need to be more regulated, but where do you draw the line? Technically, food items such as coffee and chocolate contain caffeine, so must they be regulated as well? What about other food items that contain drugs which aren't regulated by the FDA? How do you define these two groups, food versus dietary supplements, in such a way as to make them mutually exclusive? Annette Dickinson, is that a problem that you recognize?
I don't believe you can identify them as mutually exclusive, and in fact, under the law, both conventional foods and dietary supplements are considered as foods. I think it's important to recognize that the fact that they're foods doesn't mean that there isn't control over them. The Food and Drug Administration requires that claims for all foods, including dietary supplements, be substantiated, and in fact, FDA also allows health claims for many foods. For example, statements that calcium can help reduce the risk of osteoporosis, or that certain types of fiber can help reduce the risk of cancer and heart disease, and these claims are also allowed for certain supplements under those provisions. So it's been recognized for a long time that foods, as well as supplements, do have health benefits and do ultimately have disease-reducing benefits. So the line between foods and drugs has been becoming somewhat blurred over the last 15 years or so that FDA has been adopting this health claims policy, and I think it is no longer possible to have a situation where you don't allow health benefit claims for foods or supplements.
Mm-hmm. Let's get another caller in. Ulysses is on the line from Newport News in Virginia, where I assume you're out shopping for Sou'westers today.
Oh, yes.
Go ahead with your question.
No, it's primarily a comment. I used to work in the health food industry, and one of the things I agree with was your first person that was on the show was I personally feel that there should be some type of regulation. Primarily, I get upset every time I hear about a supplement product saying there is no side effects. When I go look at this product in itself and I pull a book out of the library on my own personal reference, there's a whole listing of side effects regarding that product. And that's what I feel there should be more regulation in the supplement business as far as when people say or products say there is no known side or no side effects.
Mm-hmm.
I also agree with Mr. the guy who talks about the consumer lab. When I used to work in the health food industry, a lot of times I recommended a lot of people to go look at certain products. When they were asking me what the potency, what is the status of the product, I said go to consumer lab and you'll find out about particular products, whether it's the company that I work for or other companies in itself.
Well, that unsolicited endorsement for Dr. Cooperman there. But one of the things, again, that you talk about in your book was exactly what Ulysses was also describing, that there sometimes are not discussions of possible side effects or possible, as we mentioned earlier with Dr. Fontanarosa, in effect on pharmaceutical drugs.
Yeah, I think it would be a great thing if supplements had to require that kind of warning label that drugs require as well. And I don't think it's the kind of thing that's going to would take tens of millions of dollars to put in place, as opposed to actually going out and having to check facilities and products. Warning labels would be a great step in the right direction.
Actually, one of the benefits of DSHEA is that it contains a provision that permits dietary supplements to have warning labels or cautionary statements about interactions or about any kind of adverse effect that may occur. And I think you are seeing already, and we'll see more in the future, that more products are doing this, because many consumers, like our caller, do need and want that information.
Ulysses, thanks very much for the call. We appreciate it.
No problem. Yeah, have a good day.
And you stay undercover, will you?
Oh, I will.
Okay.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Annette Dickinson, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you so much.
Annette Dickinson is the president of the Council of Responsible Nutrition, which is based here in Washington, D.C. She joined us by phone from Tucson, Arizona, where I believe she's attending a conference there of the dietary supplement industry. We appreciate very much her time. An email we have from Elizabeth Moore. Where can I find information about possible interactions between herbal and dietary supplements and prescription drugs? In particular, I'd like to know if there are any known effects of kelp supplements on the metabolism of antidepressants.
I don't have an answer to that last specific question, but there is a great deal of information on drug interactions. Our website, consumerlab.com, and the book focuses on those issues, as well as looking at the actual products themselves. It's very important, and this recent article in JAMA, also on St. John's Wort and its potential interactions, highlights the significance of this, where it was shown that St. John's Wort, an herb used for basically for depression, can interact with, I think, about 70% of drugs that are on the market, and so that you would actually have to change the dosage. So it's a very important question. I certainly recommend consumerlab.com. There are probably other sources on the web and the libraries, but that information is out there. I'm not sure the answer to kelp, though.
Our guest is Dr. Todd Cooperman. He's co-author of the consumerlab.com's Guide to Buying Vitamins and Supplements. What's Really in the Bottle? It's just out. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's go now to Michael, who's with us from Mount Airy in Georgia.
Hello, another great show.
Thank you.
I basically wanted to say that for right now, I kind of almost live on supplements. And, I know that fruits and vegetables give you really what you need, and they give you a lot of things that you can't get from supplements. But I don't have the time. And I also wanted to say that, I think your first guest, the doctor that was advocating more legislation,
mm-hmm.
that, I feel like the Western medical industry needs to catch up. Europe seems to be doing much more with supplements, using supplements for medicinal purposes. They've done studies. Supplements have been used for thousands of years. The Chinese, traditional Chinese medicine, has been using it successfully for thousands of years. And it just seems more like a ploy that instead of Western doctors trying to catch up and learn about the supplements and what's good, what isn't, how to treat their patients. Many patients don't tell the doctors what they're taking because they're afraid to.
Mm-hmm. When you say you're living on supplements, you're not taking them instead of food, are you?
Well, not entirely, no. But, I eat kind of a base or basic meals, and then, supplement the rest.
Oh, I see.
So that I get all the vitamins and minerals that I need to be getting.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Can we get your response to that, Dr. Cooperman? And again, some degree, the suspicion that the medical establishment is just trying to horn in here.
The medical establishment is coming up a learning curve. I know orthopedic surgeons 3-4 years ago, people might mention they heard about glucosamine and they'd poo-poo it, and now they're recommending it. I mean, I know because people come to our website to find out which brands to buy.
Mm-hmm.
So they are looking at it much more seriously and beginning to kind of integrate this into medicine slowly. Cardiology, we're actually asked to speak at a lot of cardiology conferences. Apparently, there's a lot of kind of more holistic approaches going on with cardiology. So I agree with the caller that there can be there's more integration to be done. But I appreciate that the medical community has a very skeptical eye, and I think in the long run, that skepticism is important, and may save people from some significant problems.
Let's get another call in. Stephanie's with us from Choctaw, Oklahoma.
Hi.
Hi.
Hi. I have to say that I'm in total agreement with the caller that just voiced his opinion about the medical profession horning in, as you put it. But also, I'd like to add that I'm shocked and abhorred by the number of people who just go out to buy herbal medicines without doing any research. It's like they see a commercial or an ad in a newspaper, and they just go out and buy it willy-nilly. They don't even think that this might require more than two brain cells to rub together to come up with a viable solution to whatever health problem they think they might have. I'm also really bothered by the fact that many people turn to supplements because they can't afford regular medication. They can't afford to go to the doctor. They're forced to treat themselves, or as the previous caller said, they don't have any confidence in their doctors for whatever reason, whether it's poor treatment of the person through the attitude of the doctor, or perhaps the doctor is ignoring their complaints or their symptoms.
Let's get a response from Dr. Cooperman.
Sure. I agree that people need to be skeptical. They shouldn't just run out, hear that a supplement can cure something and or prevent something and just go buy it for a number of reasons. Really, anyone who's considering using a supplement or already using one should really ask themselves four questions. The first should be, are the health claims true? Is there really good evidence behind those claims? Second, are the ingredients in the supplement they're looking at consistent with what was used in the clinical trials where the efficacy was shown? In many cases, there's kind of a lot of borrowed science. Something's been shown to work, but...
Going to have to get to three and four pretty quickly.
Okay. Three is really, does the product contain, what it has on the label? And four is the issue of the side effects or drug interactions.
Well, Dr. Todd Cooperman, thanks very much for being with us today. We appreciate it.
Sure, thank you.
Dr. Cooperman is the president and founder of ConsumerLab.com. He was with us from our bureau in New York. When we come back from a break, the best housing and the best surfing available in a hurricane. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News.